Blog Talk Radio.
Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West, the most haunted city in the country. Well, just got back from the Necronomicon in Santa Fe. That's the second con in 2 weeks. Saw a lot of people. And I had a number of my titles available for folks to look at and enjoy. We were showing preliminary videos of our TV series, Beyond Roswell. You'll be able to go on Facebook and see it, and I'll have it up on BeyondRoswellTV.com sometime this week. You know, the interesting thing is when you do these events, people who have had adventures and never talked about them suddenly have a forum where folks aren't going to laugh at them if they say something wild and out of the ordinary. I heard some fascinating stories, and you'll see some of them in my upcoming books. Mystery Man will be out very shortly, and though I have resisted the urge to do it, I'm going to start doing ebooks and audiobooks. A number of people who are full-time RVers explained to me the necessity of having the books they wanted to read on Kindle and Nook. And I hadn't even considered that. So we're gonna start looking at that. Well, now the New Mexico is a very, very strange state. There's a lot of really unbelievable things that take place there. But it's not the only place where strange things take place. For example, as much as I've read, I had never heard about Nero's sunken city. The Bay of Naples has one of the world's most stunning underwater archaeological sites, the lost Roman city of Baiae. Now, we've all heard of Pompeii, which was overwhelmed by volcanic activity. Well, this city is 150 miles south of Rome, in the actual shadow of Mount Vesuvius. And this coastal city once played a pivotal role in the Roman Empire. Caesar, Cicero, Mark Antony, Nero, all had very ornate villas there. And it was a setting for one of the Roman age's most sinister murder plots. And as much as I've read about history, I had no idea that there was an actual murder attempt on Nero's life. Now, from the 1st to the 3rd century A.D., Baiae was the most exclusive spot in the Roman Empire. A place of fantastic wealth, opulence, and debauchery. Rome's elite went there to consort and conspire. Kind of the Roman Empire's version of Las Vegas. Well, just as at Pompeii, disaster struck. Activity from the nearby volcano caused half the city to sink into the ocean. And it was forgotten for more than 1,000 years. Little was once known about what life was like there, but drew Rome's rich and famous to this city in the first place, or why exactly it vanished. Now, recently, an international team of scientists, led by Dr. Barbara David, began carefully surveying the ruins, preserving, identifying, and logging every inch of this forgotten site. Beneath the waves, they encountered ruins three times the size of Pompeii. A network of roads, miles of brick walls, rich marble floors, beautifully preserved marble statues, expensive frescoes, and splendid mosaics. The remains of one enormous luxury villa after another. And located less than 3 miles south of Baiae is the Piscina Mirabilis, an ancient cistern that still stands today. So large. In fact, it was the largest cistern in the entire empire. It held 12,600 cubic meters of fresh water, brought in from the Apennine Mountains to be enjoyed by the wealthy of the day. As they explored the ruins, the scientists discovered Baiae's wealthy residents had even converted natural resources into luxuries. Expensive private fish farms, artificial oyster beds, and something very unusual for the time, a constant supply of fresh water piped in from 90 miles away. Now, though clean water was essential for drinking and cooking and bathing, it was also needed for the grand fountains and water features that symbolize this city's enormous wealth. Well, as might be expected, all this excess and opulence had a dark side. And one emperor, more than any other, was famous for his hedonism, and that was Nero. He was a cruel, eccentric psychopath who persecuted Christians and, according to legend, burned Rome to the ground so that he could fiddle as it burned. Well, he found an escape in Baiae, a place where he could indulge in his sadistic fantasies away from the watchful eyes of Rome's ruling class. Though he was the undisputed ruler of the Roman Empire, there was a certain check and balance system in place. Now, nothing as crass as impeachment. They'd just hang his ass. He hosted indulgent parties there, but these banquets were just about food of fortune. They featured sex and debauchery, But he became Nero's favorite playground where he could rule the empire while indulging in a lifestyle of extreme decadence. He felt such a connection to Baiae that he began to convert the villas of others, including his aunt Domitia's villa, which he acquired in suspicious circumstances when she unexpectedly died. Now he owned two villas, his aunt as well as the imperial villa he had inherited from Claudius. But even those didn't give him the privacy and freedom and luxury he so desperately craved. And as his megalomania raised alarm back in Rome, he spent more and more time in Baiae, choosing to stay with a friend, Gaius Calpurnius Piso, a wealthy nobleman who reputedly owned the finest villa in the area. It was set on vast grounds, had an unbelievably ornate garden, two bath complexes, fish ponds, and even a private jetty to the sea. And while Nero enjoyed the life of the undisputed ruler of the Roman Empire, he didn't realize Piso was planning to kill him and claim the throne for himself. Now, Roman texts that discussed the murder plot did not reveal the location of Piso's home. As far as everybody knew, it was lost to time until underwater archaeologists uncovered a clue amid one of the ruined complexes, a pipe inscribed with Piso's family mark. Finally, they could study the splendid villa where Piso plotted Nero's assassination and the coup that he believed would bring him to the throne. Well, unfortunately for Piso, Nero learned about the conspiracy and ordered the treacherous nobleman to commit suicide. It wasn't the first time Nero killed someone there. 6 years earlier, he took care of another rival for power, his own mother. Agrippina was an ambitious woman who schemed and murdered to get her son on the throne. And once he was on the throne, she, in effect, viewed herself as co-ruler. But 5 years into his reign, Nero got tired of his mother's interference, so he devised an ingenious murder plot of his own. He invited Agrippina as a guest of honor to a sumptuous banquet at his villa in Baiae. And after the banquet, he escorted her to a boat that had been secretly sabotaged. She was going to have a cruise where she could enjoy the beauty of the sea. Once at sea, the boat began to break apart, but a passing vessel rescued her and brought her back to shore. When Nero heard his mother survived, he sent soldiers to her villa to finish the job. Well, ultimately, Nero's murderous and debauched lifestyle caught up with him. In 68 AD, after a turbulent 14-year reign under Nero, the Roman Senate ran out of patience and declared him a public enemy. Kind of what Schiff is trying to do to President Trump. Nero fled, and on June 9th, 68 AD, at the age of 30, he committed suicide himself. Well, Baiae survived a little longer, but by the 4th century, its location on a seismic and active landscape led to its demise. Ironic, considering its proximity to 24 volcanoes, including Vesuvius and Solfatara, which was part of what made this coastal city so attractive to Rome's elite. Roman engineers harnessed the heat from the volcanic springs to create luxurious thermal baths and spa complexes. The pressure from the lava and the gases caused the earth to move with devastating consequences. As the subterranean chambers of molten rock and gases emptied, the ground sank 60 feet. Half of the city disappeared beneath the waves, where it waited over 1,000 years to be found. 2,000 years later, thanks to this team of scientists, these submerged villas have sprung back to life. A hedonistic paradise city ruled by an emperor who was a sandwich or two short of a picnic, in my humble opinion. Well, this next ancient secret came from Egypt, a mysterious civilization that actually started at its peak And as time passed, it degenerated. For more than 5,000 years, tomb raiders plundered the graves of Egypt's ancient pharaohs. By the 20th century, nearly every royal tomb that archaeologists entered had been ransacked. But one that had mysteriously survived contained untold riches and a mysterious pharaoh's casket made entirely of silver. Something of a unique burial find. 1928, a French archaeologist, Professor Pierre Montet, been digging at Tanis in the Nile Delta. Though other archaeologists had searched the area, Montet believed important finds could still be buried in sand. If you watched Raiders of the Lost Ark, Tanis is the city where the Ark of the Covenant was supposedly hidden. Well, Montet's hunch paid off in 1940 when his team made an extraordinary discovery. A royal tomb complex untouched by tomb raiders. Now, inscriptions revealed it was the tomb of Susenis I, a little-known ruler from Egypt's turbulent Dark Age. That was a 500-year period of conflict and political chaos beginning about 1000 B.C. If Susenis' tomb really was intact, then Montet's find could help fill a yawning gap in Egypt's history. Now, the doorway to the burial chamber was still tightly sealed with a massive block of solid granite. It took 6 days of backbreaking work to shatter this block of granite. Finally, Montet entered the tomb itself, finding gemstones, precious metals, and hundreds of figurines, some rivaling that of the tomb of King Tutankhamun, untouched for 3,000 years. Even more remarkable, when they opened the burial chamber's stone sarcophagus, the pharaoh's casket was a human form forged from 200 pounds of pure silver. He became known as the Silver Pharaoh. It was the find of a lifetime, but the timing couldn't have been worse. In Europe, Hitler's armies arrived at the French border, prepared to strike at any moment. Montet packed up the treasures and ordered the excavation site closed. When the work ceased, he rushed back to his family in France. Susenis' bones, hidden for a millennium, would be reviewed briefly in 1940, but afterwards lay unstudied for another 70 years. But recently, the treasures from his tomb, as well as physical remains, have yielded a great deal of new information. Using source material discovered by the original team and modern forensic technology, investigators are decoding the messages of the Silver Pharaoh's bones. Now, the secret to his immense riches lay hidden in the hieroglyphics on a small, insignificant silver dish from his tomb. It revealed he was more than just a pharaoh. He was a high priest as well, granting him the traditional wealth of a pharaoh and the wealth from the temple. The Silver Pharaoh's tomb was also helping researchers lift the veil on one of the biggest mysteries of Egypt's history. For years, the exact location of Ramesses II's favorite capital on the Nile, Pi-Ramesses, was one of the world's great archaeological mysteries. Not a trace of it was found above ground, which raised the question, how could one of the largest cities in the ancient world just vanish? Well, around the time Susenis became pharaoh, the Nile changed course, making life at Pi-Ramesses unsustainable. So Susenis came up with a unique solution. He had the great monuments dismantled and shifted to Tanis, moved an entire metropolis stone by stone in one of the most extraordinary feats of ancient times. But with all this wealth and power, why did Susenis choose silver for his casket? It's less expensive than gold, but it demanded a higher degree of craftsmanship to work. He clearly wanted items of quality and artistry, not just expense, to go with him to the afterlife. Today, his silver casket is one of the great treasures of the Grand Egyptian Museum, and investigators still using information from Pierre Montique's amazing find to reveal the secrets of Egypt's dark age. With his elaborate burial tomb, Susenis found he was buying a ticket to immortality. Well, actually, 3,000 years later, that's exactly what's happened. His name is well known in the halls of science. Well, from Egypt, let's turn our attention to China. 1974. Farmers were digging a well near Xi'an, China. They made an unbelievable discovery. 8,000 clay warriors, each of them 6 feet tall, weighing more than 600 pounds. Now, this find started as farmers discovered strange fragments of clay. Unbelievably sculptured in human form. Intrigued, Chinese archaeologists came to the site to excavate the soil and uncover the what was clearly an incredible army, nearly entirely intact, buried near the tomb of one of history's most powerful leaders. Now, historians eventually traced the origins of these terracotta warriors back to more than 2,000 years. According to scientists, the tomb was that of the brilliant soldier and ruthless conqueror, Qin Shi Huangdi, the self-proclaimed first emperor of China. He actually unified seven warring kingdoms into a single empire. But having reached the pinnacle of power in this life, about 221 BC, he began to think about the afterlife and began to construct an extraordinary tomb where he could spend eternity. And he needed fierce warriors to protect him in the afterlife. Now, a few hundred years prior to his time, the emperor would have filled these roles and the grave with living people. According to ancient Chinese tradition, when a ruler died, so did his entire court. From ministers and wives to royal craftsmen and any useful commoners, all ritualistically killed to serve their lord in death. By the time the first emperor took power, rulers were instead finding different ways to provide for their afterlives. Living beings were replaced with small symbolic pottery figurines. Well, as the first emperor, he wanted to do them all one better. He took the tradition of tiny tomb figures to new heights. He ordered the creation of a life-size clay army, 8,000 soldiers strong. There was infantry, archers, generals, cavalry, and no two are actually alike. Their shoes, their bodies, and their faces all appear to be different. To confirm this feat of craftsmanship, New Zealand facial recognition expert Glenn Cameron analyzed the warriors' faces using software that proved each warrior is different from the next. Now, whether they're portraits of actual soldiers that served the emperor or products of the artist's imagination is still a mystery. But there is one thing that is clear. Crafting 8,000 clay individuals on this scale, with this level of detail, in just over a decade, was a stunning achievement and an expensive one only an emperor could afford. Archaeologists identified 87 different names stamped on the warriors, believed to be individual master craftsmen, each likely aided by a team of possibly as many as 10 apprentices. It would have taken nearly 1,000 workers to sculpt the warriors. Using pounds of strong, sticky clay, these ancient artisans shaped each warrior's body by hand with a laborious technique called coiling. It enabled them to individualize the soldiers. Today, the warriors still bear traces of the shiny lacquer that coated the statues from head to toe. But these once brilliant colors vanished quickly after excavation as the lacquer dried out and flaked off, taking with it the warrior's paint. While conservation experts focused on preventing this loss, scientists are analyzing the surviving color fragments with startling results that could advance 21st century physics. You see, the warrior's purple paint, known as Chinese purple, is more than just a beautiful color. It's a chemical composition that holds unique and surprising properties. Dr. Shushatra Sebastian discovered in 2006 at Florida's National High Magnetic Field Laboratory. The super cool molecules of Chinese purple became a single magnetic wave, a unique state in quantum physics. And even more exciting, this wave lost its third dimension and cooled even further. This shift from three to two dimensions could help make better superconductors, which in turn could mean more efficient magnetic trains, lower electricity bills, and faster computers. First Emperor's ghostly army already proved themselves in battle against time and the elements, but as researchers continue to unlock new secrets hidden within these ancient masterpieces, it looks like China's terracotta warriors are ready to keep marching into the future. Now, speaking of fast computers, when we were at the National Association of Broadcasters meeting in Las Vegas several years ago, there was Hewlett Packard was there demonstrating a new computer called the Sprout, and it could do marvelous things. And I bought one. It was, well, we have someone who has called in. You're on the Ken Hudnall Show. Hello.
Hi. Very interesting show about a topic that many people. Welcome. It's a great topic. I mean, the army, you know, that the emperor had built, like that you were talking about, and you know, so many other cultures that I've studied, like the Egyptians and the Inca and Aztec, they spent so much time, you know, preparing for something that none of us really have the answer to, but there's definitely, it seems to be, you know, there's something after this, you know, like the, you know, that's why they call it the afterlife, you know, and it seems that, yeah, death is something that I don't know when it was invented, but it's definitely a fear tactic. And, you know, it led me to study science a lot over the years. And I noticed that in studying science, they, you know, there's a lot of evidence for some, you know, logically you would, you know, that alone, the science of logic tells us there has to be something after this physical existence. And the brain as a receiver of the mind, which, you know, could be the mind itself could be looked at as something spiritual or otherworldly. And, yes. You know, is there mind after death? You know, is and it seems that there would be. And if there is, which it seems scientifically to be, there had to have been mind before life, you know. So the more I study and the more honest chemists study the cell and the origins of life, the further it gets away from us. So it becomes more complex. The single cell is not just the simple organism that we were taught to believe. It's extremely complex, and there is a pseudoscience that tells us it's simple, that tells us it happened by chance, it tells us, you know, this is it. I don't even think it can be properly defined as materialism, because it's sort of like the destruction of material. That's what we see in a majority of the population that has been duped into thinking there is no there is nothing next. You know, many people have told me, oh, well, you know, you're fertilizer at that point. And I said, well, your physical body may be fertilizer, but you have, you know, I said, honestly, I said, I don't even think we're remembering where we came from. Like there's something that blocks or prevents the memory. You know, I equate it to a video game or a game where if you have the rules where, you know, you can't die in a video game or you have unlimited lives, it, or the code, it takes the fun out of it. It takes the lesson out of it too. It's kind of like if you're going to learn something, you have to be surprised. You know, the life teaches us you get tested first and then you learn. School, it retards that. It bends it backwards because it says, no, you'll study and then you'll take a test, which really dumbs a person down because I tell people, if I tested you on addition, you wouldn't have to study. That's how you know something. If you study and take a test, that's a false sense of security you have. You might not know how to do it without studying, so you really don't know it. Addition, you know. Subtraction, you know. Multiplication, you know. That's the difference in knowing something. You never, you know, anytime you're tested, you're ready. And with this next life, you know, what is it? You know, I haven't heard anybody talk about it as deeply as you did with the creation of the armies. And, you know, that emperor and these other people dedicated their entire adult lives, and probably more than that, to preparing for what's next. And I think the topic is very interesting.
There are a number of interesting points that immediately come to mind. You know, I've been doing this show for 30 years. And at one point, I had a lot of psychics come on. And some of them were so unpsychic, they couldn't have found their rear end with both hands and a flashlight. But there was one gentleman, became a friend. He could sit and look at you for a moment and tell you things there was no way on God's green earth he could know. He described my grandmother to me, who's been dead but at that point in time, she'd been dead 20 years. And there's no way he could ever have met her or even heard about her. And yet, he was talking about things that she used to discuss. And I said, where'd you get that information? She gave it to me. So does that mean some part still remains and some of us are able to communicate with that part? Certainly that appears to me to be a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And somebody like the pharaohs. When you came to the throne, even somebody as young as King Tut, who was in his teens, you started getting ready for when you're going to die. Why? What caused that preoccupation? They did some research when I was living in New York on some, they had some very ancient Egyptian mummies, some of the earliest that had been found. I was talking to one of the researchers, and he said it was absolutely amazing at a cellular level. Now, these mummies were, you know, 3, 4, and 5,000 years old. At a cellular level, the cells were still alive. They were still functioning because of the embalming technique. Now, who taught them that?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody just didn't get up one morning and say, gee, let's go and bomb people.
Yeah. Yep.
So there's a lot of questions I have, which is why the type of books I write. My 85th book just came out. And I talk about issues like that. And I've read a book a day since I was old enough to carry one.
Wow.
And I ask questions. I mean, I was the worst possible student. I would question everything. I now have 5 degrees, and that and 50 cents will get me a cup of coffee on a good day. And I still don't have any answers. But I got a hell of a lot more questions.
That's what matters. That's it's funny because there's no coincidence. And when I saw this, I've studied ancient civilizations for about 2 decades. And, you know, it makes me wonder, like what you were saying with the pharaohs, and they're getting prepared for the afterlife, even as soon as they hit the throne, mm-hmm. and, you know, possibly even people, you know, in society. It makes me wonder, it made me look at what, is this like a school? We know, it seems, what I thought was, you can't take anything physical with you. But when I see how the Central American cultures use jade, and so did some of the Oriental cultures, thinking that jade can protect them.
You're starting to break up just a little bit.
How about now? It might be a little clearer.
That's much better.
You know, so yeah, jade. It was. I don't know if the archaeologists are interpreting correctly, because the more I look and study archaeology, I see that it's not a science. It's more of a philosophy, and it is a method of searching, but the documentation of it after studying it for, you know, diligently for decades. Any scientist mm-hmm. would say, yeah, it's not a science. You know, when the whole geological column is made up, we're starting to find out now that things deposit themselves in ways that we didn't think they deposited, you know, and they're not changing it. That's what I noticed. In chemistry, you know, people will ask me, even in technical science, they'll say, well, the airplane flies, you know, so why doesn't evolution and stuff exist? And I say, well, the airplane is testable. You know, if you put it together, science can't prove anything, but it can explain how it's done, and the airplane flies. So you can test it. Whenever somebody says yeah. you can't test it, yeah, you have to think, you know. And the afterlife, I wonder, you know, I really wonder, because it brought me to say, okay, where did we come from? How were we created? And when we were created, that's, you know, what the evolution I call the state religion, basically, because it's forbidden to think this way in academic circles, or you can't get a paycheck. So it forces yeah. the person. Yeah, you know, they have to become their own entrepreneur. So I kind of studied rogue after that, which I learned much more, because I didn't have anybody holding my mind back. But it let me wonder, like, okay, I thought maybe it's the things that you can't touch physically, like your feelings, your love, your hatred, your envy. You know, it's so important to control those things, like what they say in certain mm-hmm. religious books, the 7 deadly sins. And, you know, those are real behaviors that aren't, you know, they are detrimental, you know, to people when you give in to those. So is it that? But then when I saw the cultures that, I don't know why, they would think that we, you know, jade somehow protects you in the afterlife. You know, offerings. Celtics were saying that, you know, they believed in it so much, if you lent some money, they would say, you know, pay me back in the next life. And it is a mystery. It is to say, okay, when we're done with this physical body, is the signal of the mind still coming through the way the signal to a television set is still coming through, even though the television set is off or destroyed? So are we the signal? Are we individual signals? Is it a collective signal? And I look at that as the true study of science, because anybody can employ the method. If I tell them to just believe me, then now we're not in the realm of science anymore. And that's what I see a lot with what is going on in academia worldwide. It's rare, but it's there. Like people like yourself that I meet, you know, I don't think this is a coincidence. It's amazing that your show was on and I just happened to call on it. Yeah, you really have a good insight into it, where other people I couldn't even get this far into the conversation with.
Well, when I retired, I was medically retired. I planned on playing video games. I had an Xbox, I had a recliner, a nice chest, a big screen TV, and I was set. And after 2 weeks, my wife walked in and said, "I'm not retired yet. You're not retired. Go write another book." I'd already written one that's still on the market. And I discovered if you're writing a book and you got proof that you're writing a book, folks will let you go places you never should be allowed to go and do things you never should be allowed to do. But what that does is it gives you a view of the world, I guess, unlike any other. Some of the books I've written, I've been attacked. One of my series is called The Occult Connection. And the word occult only means hidden. But I've had people go on tirades that I'm writing about the devil, because the word occult is evil. And when I say, "Have you ever read the book?" No. I'm not going to read something that's about the devil. People act on their assumptions without getting the data to really know what the hell they're talking about. And that's from the lowest person to the Oval Office. Quite often we speak and don't know what we're talking about.
Yep. English.
But if you say it often enough and loud enough, folks believe you.
Yeah. I call that the Hitler method. You tell a lie loud enough and long enough and people will start to believe it. And that's what, you know, we see it today. We have turned into a nation, and I think even a planet, of people that don't think. They'll believe overthinking. And once you believe, you can be bamboozled, you know. And I tell people, if you can't think about it and give me a reason, that's called reason, you know, because it's reasonable, then
yes.
What are you doing? You know, even the word government, I explained it to a man the other day. He has done a radio show, and he didn't know. He told me, well, you know, I was so glad he admitted it, that govern, to limit, to restrict, and meant mind from Latin. So it's basically a mind restriction, something that holds the mind back, literally, in the literal sense. And we don't, people will say, "Oh, I want a better government. And I try to explain, well, do you know what it means? Do you know mortgage means death pledge? And, you know, they had to change it for the French Quebec because, you know, it's French, and they knew, you know, why would I sign that? And English, as the more I study it, the more I see that it's been created as a type of newspeak, sort of like the George Orwell novel where he talks about the dictionary. Yes. So it gets smaller every year in his novel, and so it omits words, and we have a smaller vocabulary. But in actuality, it's the opposite. English gets bigger because it's a conglomerate language, but it gets diluted, and things mean nothing. And it's confusing, you know, especially when words are attributed to, you know, different words to the same definition or even different definitions. I tell people, you can't have that. You know, blue cannot be red. Blue is blue, and that's it. And if you want to, you know, speak of any mixing, or, you know, blue and red do make purple, you know, but blue has to be defined as blue and red has to be defined as red. And as I read more, they asked Confucius, the ancient, you know, I think they call him Kung Fuzi. They change it in English to Confucius, when they could have kept his same name, Kung Fuzi. And he said, when they said, "What would you do to take over a country?" He said, "The first thing I would do is control the language." And if you look at Thailand, you know, Siamese cats come from Siam, which is now called Thailand. Suomia, which is Finland. You know, everybody's name, Egypt, you know, was Kemet. And that's where we get the word Kemet Street. But now it's, you know, it's Egypt, because it's like an erasing of people's memory with English, and then English is worldwide. So soon the languages that could utter certain words or phrases or sounds that possibly, and this is a stretch to some scientists, it could open doorways or something that could lead into the next world. It could, you know, the myth could be true that dogs are the guardians between the two worlds and that cats can see into, you know, the next dimension. But with modern science, that becomes taboo to even study. And that is the antithesis of science, you know, to have something, you know, because I totally agree with you with the psychics. I explained to one lady, if you have 150 psychics and even just 50 or 8 or 10, you know, a small number are fake and they're not called out, it makes everybody see the whole 150 is fake. And also, yeah, you know, the real ones have to really step up. You know, I'm going to be interviewed by one soon, in a few days, and I'm not going to try to smash her and, you know, like kind of bash her or whatever. I just want to find out scientifically, like, you know, some people may see into something clairvoyantly and they don't seem to know how they're receiving that. That would probably be the most honest description if they were honest. And some might see a little deeper, you know, but there will be people that are fake. There will be people. Fake isn't a good word. I would say mental disease, because I try to let them know, look, you're thinking that something is going to happen or exist just because you believe in that. And to an extent, they know, you know, they're not being genuine. So that pursuit, you know, it's rare. I appreciate, you know, finding people like yourself that have good conversations.
Well, you know, growing up until I was about 14, if you asked me how much change was in your pocket, if I answered you immediately, I'd be correct every time. If I thought about it, I'd always be wrong. And of course, everybody wants to fit in. So in school, we would play periodically games. One of them was password, involving guessing what the word was supposed to be. They quit letting me play because I always got it. But then I quit. And then when I was in South America, on an extended vacation paid for by Uncle Sam, I knew if there was somebody around the curve of the trail that I really didn't want to deal with. But when, you know, back in the States, without the pressure, I quit. And I've seen people that, if you ask them, one young lady that I knew some years ago, I had lost something and I couldn't find it. And I was tearing my house apart. And I happened to talk to her on the phone on something totally unrelated. And she said, oh, by the way, what you're looking for? Look in the couch. And I went and looked in the couch and there it was. Now, how did she know? She didn't even know what I had lost because I didn't tell her. So everybody's mind works different. And the mind is actually an electrical generator. That's why the EKGs work. So what can you pick up and not know it?
It makes me wonder, though, again, the distinction that I think the brain might be the generator, you know, and the mind just keeps alluding to not being in the physical universe that we see now, you know. So I had to kind of make a chart to say, okay, if the mind, it's what it seems to be, you know, because what does the mind weigh, you know? We don't, you know, that's more of a, it definitely is more of a non-physical, but you know, we can weigh air if we pressurize it. Certain, you know,
well, there was a study done at a hospital a number of years ago, and I got a chance to read it. A lot of people who were terminal, they attached scales to their hospital beds. Now, why and what they were looking for, I don't have a clue, but the results they got, they could never explain. In each and every case, at the moment of death, the weight dropped 3 pounds, give or take.
Yes, sir. That study, I think it was the weight of the soul. That is an amazing study. And honestly, I think they had the scale because they know. Even the doctors that perform it probably don't know who those results are really benefiting. There's definitely a secret medical, whatever research we're doing, something else is getting this research. I get the feeling like it's kind of getting us to do the research and then looking at our results and then putting through, the societal machine to say, disregard your results or, don't worry, they'll de-influence each other to not accept the evidence, because it doesn't fit. But I've definitely heard of that. And that's true, that the soul seems, or whatever it is in the living body that leaves, seems to have a physical weight. Yeah, that's amazing that you mentioned that.
And there was another one. Your physical body has an electrical charge in it at all times. But at the moment you die, that electrical charge goes away. And I've never understood what that means, other than the fact that at the moment you die and that brain quits functioning, something important goes away.
Mm-hmm. The television set scenario, I was at a lecture a few weeks ago with Michael Cremo. He wrote Forbidden Archaeology. And when I asked the question, he was really happy. I was surprised because he said that's a great analogy, with the television set and the signal. The set is destroyed, the signal is still there. And that really seems like us. And then I asked him the question, I said, seeming that that does have a bit of plausibility, could it be that other signals could inhabit the same body? And he had some documents from, I think it was the 1800s, of a family that whose daughter claimed to have the spirit of their daughter. So her parents let her go live with the people that she was claiming to be the spirit daughter of, until I think she stayed there for about a year, he said, and then it went away. And they go, look, now it's time for her to go back with her family. And these scientific observations, his lecture was about, are not put in the mainstream. They are omitted. Darwin, his colleague, I think his name was Woodward. It was originally the Woodward-Darwin theory. But Woodward started doing psychic research. And the psychic research, Darwin had to say, look, he put it as Darwin said, you're killing our child, the evolution religion.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's rare. And if I mention anything, about evolution, other so-called scientists will immediately, it's a witch hunt, that's not scientific. Yeah. So it's like scientists have
to keep in mind that in India, for example, there have been a number of cases where young children have started, for lack of a better term, channeling deceased people, to the point that one of them even recognized the deceased person's wife and children and knew all the details of the family. And he had never set foot in the town they lived in. So, yeah, I firmly believe there can be interruptions in the signal, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Question is, what do you do about it? you got an 8-year-old child who wants to go back with his wife who's in her 40s. Bit of a disconnect there.
Yeah. It warrants so much more study, because I've heard of a story where an 8-year-old child wanted his mother to take him back to Ireland, where the planes land on the beach. So I naturally thought that's impossible. But there are planes, 2-seater planes, that do land on the beach in a certain islands off of those British Isles. And you know, it went cold after they went there. But the fact is, to get that vision and to, you know, it really lets us think, okay, what is this? What are we? I call it the theory of existence itself, as opposed to the physical existence. And some of us, you know, might get it. Me personally, I feel like my consciousness was there as I was growing up, but couldn't really come out. And as I got older, it started to develop into now where I can kind of defend myself mentally, because when I didn't have that, it was more getting along, you know, like, okay, yeah, because I didn't have, which is power, basically, to defend myself mentally. If somebody would say, you know, why, or, you know, question it, which seemingly would be reasonably questioning it. But now I see it's not reasonable. You know, when somebody says something, I say, that's not reasonable. You know, that's not scientific. If it's, you know, religious, okay, fine. It's your belief. But it's not science.
I've come to believe everything has to happen in its own time. You know, growing up, I always wanted to write a book, but I never could do it. Didn't have the patience. And I started doing my radio show in Anaheim. People kept calling in and saying, where can we get your book? I don't have a book. I'm not a writer. I'm a talk show host. Well, if you'll write it, we'll buy it. And I sat down, and the words just came. The book took me 30 days from the time I sat down to the day it hit the street. And it's still selling, and I keep having people tell me, oh, it's a wonderful book. It's this, it's that, it's the other. But why did I go from I couldn't do it to suddenly, now it takes me about 6 weeks to do a 200-page book.
Wow.
What changed? Why?
Maybe like a channeling. I have to ask you, what is the name of the book? I'm very curious.
It was the first occult connection book, UFO Secret Societies and Ancient Gods. You can find it at my website, kenhudnall.com, or you can get it on Amazon.
Okay, I just wrote it down. Amazing. I mean, could it be that maybe, like we were saying, the signal coming through to the mind may be stronger? Because when I write, I notice that sometimes I'll write about the scientific view of creation, and then I'll sometimes it'll kind of taper off, and then I'll go into, you know, looking at genetics and, you know, other parts of what I want to produce eventually, because a book is necessary. You know, I definitely can see that.
That's true. And if you're in academia, it's publish or perish. My last course that I took was communications, how to make movies. One of the classes I had to take was creative writing. And I'm sitting there, and the professor, anybody here ever written a book? And I said, yeah. Anybody written two books? Yeah. He gave up at 40. And, but how did I go from... Unfortunately, I'm being reminded my time is about up for tonight. But I would invite you to call back. I'm here every night. It's, well, Monday through Friday from 6 to 7 Mountain Time.
6 to 7 Mountain Time. I will call back. This was a wonderful conversation, and thank you for having me. It was really
great. I enjoyed the conversation. Go to kenhudnall.com, and you'll see links to a lot of my other shows there. And all the...
Okay.
I appreciate
I'm writing
you being
everything.
With me.
Thank you. Thank you. I just wrote it down.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Okay, this is Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. We've come to the end of another show, so until tomorrow night at 6, y'all have a great evening.